This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. When our CD player broke down a couple of years ago, my husband and I thought we'd have it repaired. But the repairman told us if he needed parts, he might not be able to get them. And he said, frankly, it would cost you a lot less to buy a new one. Now, when something isn't broken, we may still decide to buy a new computer or cell phone. We may buy a new car because we like the new style or the status that comes along with the ride. Then there's stuff we rid ourselves of without thinking twice about it. Kleenex, paper coffee cups, Band-Aids. Well, today we're going to take a look at obsolescence. Turns out it provides a very interesting way to look at modern American history. Our guest this afternoon is Giles Slade, an independent scholar and freelance writer. He's the author of Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Giles Slade. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America is published by the Harvard University Press. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Giles Slade, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. It seems that we are of two minds about acquiring things and disposing of them. We're critical of consumerism on the one hand and the throwaway ethic. At the same time, we like convenience and we like new stuff.
Right.
Why the ambivalence?
Well, technology is a really double-edged sword. It's it provides us with this wonderful, enriching way of life and takes us to faraway places like the moon and Mars, but at the same time, it creates an enormous amount of toxic waste and encourages us to throw out anything used or broken and buy it again next year or go into debt to buy it.
Yeah. What? So,
sorry.
Go ahead.
There's a man called David Nye who writes about the technological sublime in America and the role that technology plays being similar to the wonders of nature. But he says it's always, double-edged. There's always this wonderful natural aspect to it, and at the same time, there's a dark side.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk a little bit here then about, the critique back in the 1950s of Vance Packard and others like him in the Hidden Persuaders, and that take on why we acquire and why we throw away.
Mm-hmm. Vance Packard was a journalist whose magazine went bust, I guess, in the late 50s, and he decided to write books. And the first book he wrote was about advertising, but it contained a large section on planned obsolescence. And he later went on to write another book exclusively about planned obsolescence. And basically, he exposed the fact that car manufacturers and also washing machine manufacturers made goods, cars and washing machines, that lasted only 3 years, and in fact were planned to last only 3 years. And he sparked this enormous debate about planned obsolescence.
Yeah.
Or maybe he didn't spark it, maybe he just added to it. It was kind of a snowball already rolling down the hill.
Yeah. And the second book was The Wastemakers, correct?
The Wastemakers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, there is something else, and you write about this, his critique. It's not completely satisfactory. And then you write a little bit about a fellow by the name of Colin Campbell.
Right.
And something else that came along in that chapter of the book, which is relatively late in the book, is the thing about technology like the cell phone and text messaging, instant messaging, and why we're drawn to it or why younger people have been drawn to it.
Sure.
And one of the interesting answers that was given by a cell phone user who texts messages is that it gives us community. So there are all kinds of things at work here, are there not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that is at work is what I try to expose in the book. There's about 100 years of conditioning now that makes us desire new goods. And Colin Campbell's idea of the neophiliac is somebody who's got this kind of internalized ideology that's reinforced by, you know, generations of wanting new stuff and thinking that new stuff makes you a good person, successful person. And IT is really the cutting edge of that. IT is plugged into success. The more powerful computer, the better text messenger, the new model BlackBerry is going to make you much more efficient at your job, much more successful. And it also has to do with the group of people that you belong to, especially if you're a young person, the culture that you belong to, what you're text messaging about. Cell phones are, when I wrote the book, cell phones, I guess, were the thing that went out of date most frequently, but now it's iPods. And iPods are really a cultural phenomenon.
Hmm.
They're not so much about communication as they are about self-identification and belonging to a group.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, tell us a little bit about iPods. I have a cell phone.
Okay.
I don't have an iPod.
Yeah, well...
That tells you a lot about me,
and
I'm wearing a wristwatch, so...
Yeah, there you go. So we're both dinosaurs, but
yeah.
My wife bought an iPod because Business Week interviewed me and then put the interview on a podcast, and we couldn't hear it, so she bought the cheapest model, the Nano, and we still haven't figured out how to download it, but somewhere on Business Week and somewhere on iTunes, there's me in a podcast talking about this and saying nasty things about Steve Jobs. But it's a fascinating little device. I mean, the dream that I'm sure you're much younger than I am, Celeste, but, you know, when I was growing up, in the very late 60s and early 70s, you know, a personal stereo was the absolute best thing that you could have, and a record collection that was just an extensive record collection of everything you've ever loved. And what the iPod does is it takes that idea of you know, this encyclopedic record collection and makes it available on this tiny little device. So that you can, and makes it portable, so you can groove and kind of weave your way through public spaces and not be forced to interact with people and not have to, you own your own time and you own your own space. It's wonderful, but at the same time, it's disposable because it only lasts about a year, maybe less than a year, and it's full of all kinds of toxic goodies, just like your cell phone.
Yeah.
Lead, cadmium, barium, beryllium, mercury, you know, arsenic, you name it.
Yeah. And cell phones, they've been built to last. I don't know how long an iPod is built to last for.
An iPod's built to last 1 year. It loses, the battery, which is sealed inside the iPod, loses 70% of its functionality after 1 year. And there's a new model that's just come out that's better. So you want to throw the old one into the green garbage bag, which is the most dangerous thing you can do with it, and buy the new one, or get your dad to buy a new one.
Yeah.
Which is, I guess, what my son wants me to do.
Now, cell phones have been built to last for a number of years, but on average, we get rid of them much more quickly than they have life.
Yeah, last year I think it was about 18 months, but now it's down to a little over a year. It's less than a year in Japan. Mobile intense societies like Scandinavia, it's about hovering at about 6 to 8 months. The amount of toxins contained in one device, isn't really significant, but, you know, there are hundreds of millions of them. So every time you toss them away, 68 million iPods, hundreds of millions of cell phones, every time you toss them away, and because of the size, they can't be reused, recycled, and very easily. So the temptation is just to throw it into the green garbage bag, and which goes into the landfill. Eventually, the toxins seep out into the groundwater, and then you can't get rid of them.
Yeah, that green garbage bag is not very green at all, really.
Recycling is a word that covers a multitude of sins, you know?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because I mentioned the CD player that we had that was broken. And so the fellow told us it's not worth it. So it sat for a couple of years in the basement until just a couple of months. Yeah, I thought, well, gee, we don't want to throw it in the trash.
It's impossible to estimate how many electronic devices are in storage, you know, in the basement or in the shed or in the garage, you know, and that's one of the real dangers, one of the real problems, because it's hard to tell after generations of making this stuff how much there actually is that we're going to have to dispose of.
Yeah. So there it sat for a couple of years until a couple of months ago when there was a countywide recycling event for electronics.
Right.
And so I dutifully loaded up the car with a couple of things that were like the CD player. How common are these events? And, you know, as you write in the book, recycling, you know, it cuts two ways. It can obscure some ills.
Yeah, usually in those county events, they usually publish what they're going to do with them, which is a really good thing, because often, you know, a take-back program will stockpile it for a while, and then it may eventually end up in a container shipped illegally off to China or to India, where it's, you know, broken apart in very crude ways by people who poison themselves and their children doing it. Or maybe gets reused, sent into the market again. So the good thing about those county take-back programs is that they make explicit what it is that they're going to do with them. And so you really have to read the fine print.
Yeah.
It's very expensive to get rid of this stuff. And I guess the smaller it is, the smaller the device is, the more difficult it is to reuse and recycle. So, and like I say, there's an awful lot of it. I noticed that on the NPR website, you've got a special about digital TV. And
On our website, yeah.
Yeah, and digital TV, the FCC has mandated a shift from analog to digital TV by 2009. That's going to be an environmental disaster. We think, very conservatively, 300 million analog TVs in the United States. But really, there are many more, because we only started counting 9 years ago. We've been manufacturing these since 1945. You know, everybody I've talked to has one in the garage or the, you know, basement or the, you know, wherever the storage place is. And so, and each one of these contains, you know, 5 to 10 pounds of at least lead. You know, there's many other things in them, but you know, just the lead alone. So, you know, imagine 10 pounds times 300 million. Where's all that going to go? The weirdest thing is there aren't even enough containers or container ships to ship them illegally to China and India anymore. It's just this immense problem.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Giles Slade, author of Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Champaign-Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello, is this me?
That's you. Go ahead.
Okay. I didn't catch your line number, and I had to ask if it was mine. Anyway, I grew up with a grandfather clock in the front hall, which was the only room tall enough to take it. And I don't think it ever broke anything. Yeah. And it had been passed down from, you know, generations. And it was the wooden case and metal guts. And my father wrote an article on Grandfather Wasn't So Dumb, and that was on energy conservation. And that is, he calculated how much power there was, because once a week he had to raise the so many kilogram weight. That wasn't very much, like 1 kilogram, 1 meter. And that as it ticked, fell in a week, the meter. And he calculated that was like a microwatt, which is, I suppose, comparable now to a wristwatch.
Did he work out?
The wristwatch takes batteries.
And the batteries, how much food he needed to do that.
How much food?
Yeah. How many calories?
Not much, but you'd eat it anyway, and besides it's exercise. Anyway, which we now have treadmills. I'm interested in the use of batteries in this country and the description on the side of the package, dispose of properly.
Yeah, yeah, what does it mean, right?
Yep. So anyway, the clocks, many things were much more efficient in terms of energy usage than they are now.
Yeah,
even though we've gone from vacuum tubes to transistors, the things that ran by hand that wound up when you needed them and so forth.
And you can still, if not in America, but if you live in, say, Latin America, you can still get devices like that. Motorola has a really good hand-crank phone. I was corresponding with the designer of it the other day. That's just not available in America. We're really battery happy, and batteries which used to be full of lead are now full of mercury, and they're just an environmental disaster. So you know, imagine. I mean, my son's just came back from camp, and he's got a hand cranked LED flashlight that doesn't require batteries. And I'm thinking, why don't they have similar devices for cell phones? So you don't have to plug it in.
Yeah.
Just whenever you want it, you just wind it up.
Yeah.
iPods. Why can't you hand crank an iPod? And the only reason is that the life of the battery allows them to control the life of the device, and they don't want the device to last for very long.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're very welcome.
Nice story about the grandfather clock.
Yeah. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Our guest this afternoon, Giles Slade, an independent scholar and freelance writer. He is the author of Made to Break, Technology and Obsolescence in America. Well, what inspired you to begin looking into obsolescence?
I got to it by a long route. I was working, teaching American culture in the United Arab Emirates when 9/11 happened, and I guess the university I was teaching at had a madrasa that was sending students off to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and things became kind of unpleasant. So I resigned, came back to Canada by January of 2002. And I was really struck by, I had culture shock. I was walking around Vancouver feeling that everybody was being really impersonal and really curt. You know, Arab culture, you spend a lot of time doing nothing. You spend a lot of time bargaining over a nickel, you know, exchanging greetings and just interacting socially. And I wondered where we lost the sense of, you know, kind of durability and where everything had sort of speeded up so that we didn't care about each other anymore. When I had a lot of free time, so I started doing some reading, and it seemed to me that our callousness began with our attitude towards material goods. And then something my father said about planned obsolescence sort of popped out of the blue, and I started following that.
Very interesting. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign now, line one. Hello.
Line one?
That's you. Go ahead.
Oh, I just, this is another generian calling.
Hi there.
And I have an aphorism. It takes as much time and finances to dispose of things as it does to acquire them.
Huh.
Is that
correct? What was the first part of that? It takes time and finances?
It takes as much time.
As much time and finances.
To dispose of things as it does to acquire them.
Yeah.
Correct?
Need energy on both ends, don't you?
Yep, and the more we have, the less time we have. That's all. Just an old lady meditating on today's life.
Let me just pick your brains a minute here.
Yes.
Do you remember, I guess, the introduction of nylons in the First World War, or the Second World War, rather?
Mm-hmm.
Is that an important memory for you?
Yes, but, pardon, what memory do I have?
I'm sorry, since you're an octogenarian, I wonder if you remember during the Second World War, the introduction of nylons.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And did you happen to notice that they were thicker when they were first introduced?
They're made differently now.
Yeah, much differently, much more fragile. And the denier, the thickness, I think is much finer. So they
But it's also more irritating to the skin.
Oh, is it really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't wear them, so I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Well, I just this is probably a far out. As I said, when one is a nonagenarian, life is viewed differently.
Uh-huh.
So excuse me for
no.
Uh-huh. But there are advantages and disadvantages.
Have you noticed a decline in durability over your lifetime?
Oh, yes. Well, what is the saying now? They make things so they don't last. I think 3 years, is that correct? Is
3 years.
What things are supposed to
be? 3 years is what's called a durable good. It's hard to believe,
yes,
isn't it?
Well, I have things that are 150 years old that still work very well.
Uh-huh.
So, anyhow, thank you for...
very nice speaking.
Informing me about something about which I know nothing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And I expect that the listener, like myself, doesn't know much about iPods, but I think she knows quite a bit.
It's interesting. You know, since I've written the book, people have been sort of coming out of the woodwork and telling me about things that from the turn of the century or the early teens that are still working. There was an engineer I was speaking with in New Orleans who said that despite the fact that, you know, the levees failed, there were wood screw turbines that had been built at the turn of the century, and they were still working after the levees had failed and are still working today. There's apparently a light bulb in California that's been in a fire hall that's been switched on since 1905, and it's still working. So there's been this kind of sea change in our attitude towards durability, our expectations of the goods, and also the engineering that goes into these devices, and we're just we don't demand as much as we could of them anymore.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener.
Sure.
Caller in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you doing? The durability issue is really interesting because I knew a guy who's a systems analyst years ago. And he told me over the years, he'd been doing this for about 25 or 30 years, he said that the product testing was switched from the manufacturer to the consumer, and that you would make something that was reliable enough that left the factory that if it failed, it would be the consumer would be testing the product. And I thought, well, that's an insult to the consumer. But he said, we don't care because they just send it back to us and we just replace it, the disposable idea. And I think that really fits in with your thesis. Yeah. But I wanted to say that I sort of think when you're talking about 100 years of conditioning, I think that's a valid assessment of modern marketing procedures. I did advertising for years, and I marketed things to people, and I sort of got a guilty conscience about it. And I still do it occasionally, but not as much as I did. But I also thought that, in a sense, I look at this as a philosophical thing, that in a sense we have these, I think of us as a species with an infinite mind. We think of things like eternity, immortal, I mean, for ourselves, this soul we supposedly have, and we sort of extrapolate that into everything else. We can have endless growth, endless products, endless consumption. I mean, if you look at, all you have to do is read the Wall Street Journal for a month, and all you'll get is growth, 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 and consumption, 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 and it's illogical to think of the other. I mean, it's illogic to think that it can possibly exist. I mean, but I really want to thank you for your book. It sounds really interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. You want to comment on the listener's comments?
There's a gentleman called Lester R. Brown who's written a book called Plan B, and now he's written a new book called Plan B 2.0, and it's about this delusion that we have about growth and how it's just completely unsustainable and how we've imparted this delusion, I guess, to China and to India, and how they aren't going to be able to sustain it. But the worst part of it is that because they aren't going to be able to sustain it, we aren't going to be able to sustain it anymore. So we have to now go to Plan B, which is, I guess, something that Europe has been working on for a while.
Yeah, and then Plan B is not good enough, so you got to have Plan B 2.0.
Well, Plan B, I guess, is, you know, maybe much more limited growth. The advantage of planned obsolescence is, like this gentleman said, you know, it promoted this economic growth that strengthened us and gave us the best standard of living in the world, and, you know, also put us on the moon at the same time. But now, you know, our garbage is about to overwhelm us, so we can't sustain it anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. This is something you write about, too, in the book Made to Break. Obsolescence was once a progressive value.
Yeah. I guess the Industrial Revolution produced too many goods, so they had to invent a way of shortening the lifespan of the goods so that the goods would be consumed and then consumed again.
And once
peak production was reached, then economic growth and economic strength followed.
Yeah, and there were actually campaigns to end thrift.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
The merchants, I guess, were at the end of the First World War, were very unhappy with the government thrift campaigns, and they launched their own national advertising campaign to promote the opposite of thrift. You know, and basically, this is where Christmas comes from. They had things like, spend your savings now, thrift is miserliness, that kind of thing, and they can. And it went sort of hand in glove with, I guess, a new kind of life, bohemian lifestyle from New York City, and the age of the flapper sort of took hold, and people started consuming more, going into debt more, and thrift really went out the window.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about conditioning. We've used that word a couple of times here already this afternoon.
Sure.
And a great conditioning story, I think, is the National Biscuit Company, You Need a Biscuit.
Sorry, I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. You Need a Biscuit.
All right. Yeah.
Tell us about that. Now, there is conditioning for you.
Well, before disposability ever came about, people were really struggling with how to increase consumption and guarantee their themselves, manufacturers were how to guarantee themselves a continuing market. A lot of goods were sold generically, like crackers in a cracker barrel. You didn't really know where they came from. They weren't sealed up in a box. You didn't have any kind of brand identity for them. So I guess the first brands were really McCormick agriculture machinery and Singer sewing machines. And You Need a Biscuit borrowed the idea of brand identification, developed this sealed package to guarantee freshness and dryness in their crackers, and they were so successful that a variety of companies, United Cigar, Procter & Gamble, copied them, and branding became a way to guarantee that the consumer got a good product every time he bought the product. So it kind of replaced generic buying. And a lot of these packaging things were disposable, and a lot of them were made out of paper because paper was, the new product that had been brought on in the 19th century had been made very cheap by the Industrial Revolution, and that contributed to disposability. And then a lot of disposable products came along, and so branding and disposability are the two things that you need before planned obsolescence can happen. You need brand loyalty so that people won't jump from iPod to a generic MP3 player. And you need disposability so that people won't feel bad about throwing away their iPod and getting a new one.
Yeah, and also with the You Need a Biscuit, there is the message, you need this.
Yeah. And it's funny because it was positioned against another company called I Want a Biscuit. I want a biscuit never did as well. I need a biscuit.
I need a biscuit. Let's talk with another listener, caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Actually, there's two points here. One is when you talk about the disposal or the throwaway part, packaging. I think I either read someplace or maybe heard it on public radio or whatever, that 27% of, in other words, the things that are in our dumpsters are thrown away is actually packaging.
So that actually sounds low. Wow.
That sounds low.
Yeah.
Well, it might be just the packaging, you know, the plastics, the stuff we put it in, you know, the cardboard.
Right.
Or maybe it was 30% or whatever. But when you think of, you know, the throwaway society, how much?
Yeah. I was in Chicago for the Printers World Book Fair a couple of weeks ago. And I have a 2-year-old, almost 2 years old, and I've been looking around for this truck in Canada. I couldn't find it, a Toyota recycling truck. And I went into a Target the last night I was in Chicago and found one at the back of the shelf, and I bought it, and I had to cut it out of the packaging so that I get it in my luggage. And the amount of packaging that surrounded this truck, when I took the truck out, and you know, it's just a little polyethylene thing. Weighed about twice as much as the truck did. You know,
yeah.
So there was a huge brightly colored box, cardboard box, and another cardboard box inside that, which made the thing, you know, two or three times the size of the actual truck, which I could eventually put into my briefcase.
Like maybe they went meant for you to recycle. You know,
right.
Use the truck to recycle.
yeah, they're encouraging me. Yeah, they're encouraging my son to recycle. But you know, I have to throw the package out. The package was immense.
But and, you know, when you think of the Tonka, which was this thing was like I don't know if they're still manufacturing those to be as sturdy as they used to be. But I mean, those things would last forever. They almost you could actually fall. You know.
Yeah, the metal ones, the yellow metal ones.
Yeah,
and try and get those today. I can't find them anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember in 93, I bought a bulldozer for a Japanese friend who was visiting, but I can't find them anymore.
You know, another concept that I don't mention in your book or not, but in marketing, the terminology is known as the 80-20 principle, which is, 20% of the market uses 80% of the products.
Right.
You know, in terms of, and that's also a very sad commentary when we look into it. You know.
Right. And I guess Henry Ford, a man of another age, tried to work against that by making his product inflexible and then allowing economies of scale over the years of production of the Model T. To bring down the price so that almost every American could afford it, but eventually he ran into competition from GM and was just destroyed by it. It's very hard to imagine a way to do this now.
So excellent show.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Giles Slade, our guest this afternoon here on the program. He is the author of Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. We've got about 10-12 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, you can give us a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Sometime back in my introduction, I mentioned that there's a lot of things that we have in life that we throw out, we get rid of without thinking twice about it. And I'm quite happy to do that in terms of things like Band-Aids and Kleenex and that kind of thing. So, you know, well, maybe you would talk with us for a moment or two about, you know, hygienic products and how, you know, throwing that stuff out is just fine and dandy.
Well, I guess this is how we became conditioned to accept disposability. Originally, it was products of personal hygiene that encouraged people to think that you know, tossing trash out was okay. I guess it starts with paper shirt parts with men. This was the first really large scale disposable product. I guess at the turn of the century. Around 1900, most men lived in rural parts of the country and didn't really have access to laundry. Most men were single. Most men lived in the country, and so they bought parts for their shirts. The fronts were called bosoms, cuffs and collars that they'd wear until they got dirty, and then just throw them into a cook stove and burn them. And millions of these things were consumed. Weekly, and you know, a real growth industry started. So, paper manufacturers started to invent new products like paper straws that replaced rye stalks for drinks,
mm-hmm.
and then King Gillette came around and developed a razor blade, and there was a revolution in latex and rubber. So personal products like condoms became, which actually prevented a lot of disease, became much more common than they had been before. And then somebody noticed that actually women were beginning to spend about 85% of the family budget, and there were no disposable products directed towards women. So after the First World War, Kimberly Clark had warehouses full of cellulose cotton that they'd stockpiled. It was new material. They'd stockpiled it for bandages during the First World War. They were expecting the war to last 4 extra years, and it didn't. And so they had all this stuff. They paid for it, and they didn't know what to do with it. They sat down, and they invented a sanitary napkin. The first one, I guess, was released in 1895.
Yeah.
Called Kotex, and they priced them at a nickel and put them in women's washrooms all across the nation, and they were an overnight success. And this really eroded thrift, because women up until that point had kept kind of bags of rags in order to create their own sanitary napkins. And Kimberly Clark was so successful that they... within a couple of years, they brought out Kleenex, which was another cellulose cotton product. They had too much of this stuff to wipe the cold cream off your face. But then women started using it to sneeze in when they had cold. So they changed the marketing completely and made it for blowing your nose into. And after that, other companies like Johnson & Johnson realized what was happening, that the equation of women and hygiene was vital to creating a disposable product, and disposable products could be sold again and again, so they're a real money maker. So they developed the Band-Aid, and the first Band-Aids didn't do very well until they guaranteed by a machine process that they were antiseptic and germ-free, and then those took off. And by this time, of course, people were used to taking things and just throwing them out, and it grew from there.
Very interesting. We've got some more folks who've called in and like to talk with you. So let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about some quality control that I knew about. In 1948, I just finished college, and so I went to work at a headlight factory in Lexington, Kentucky, and they had one place where they had their quality control, and they had these seal beam headlights shooting up in the air, timing them.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, this is good. They're making it so it'll last a long time. I found out it was just the opposite. They kept shaving the wires and everything, because the way they were at that time, they would last as long as a car.
Right.
They didn't make any money.
Uh-huh.
So they were deliberately cutting down that so it would not last as long.
Yeah.
I thought that was kind of a disgrace.
Do you happen to remember the name of the company?
Yes, I do.
Can you say it?
General Electric.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In Lexington,
well, it's
Kentucky.
Funny. It's funny. Let me tell you a story about General Electric. The first known example of this is from an antitrust suit against General Electric from 1932, and there's a memo from the Research and Development Department explaining how they'd cut the efficiency of their flashlight light bulbs by 60%.
Oh, my.
They made them brighter so that they could sell them, you know, but they cut them by 60%, and they had calculated how much money they were going to make out of this. It never actually went into production, but it was clear that, you know, by the fourth year of depression, they were experimenting with shortening the lifespans of things so that they could sell more. And General Electric and Westinghouse had the first research and development teams in the country, and there where it all started.
And then I want to tell you something else. You know, when you buy things, they're in a big plastic bubble lots of times, lots bigger than they needed.
Yeah.
Well, I worked in a department store, and I wondered why in the world this was so big. You know, you couldn't stick it in your pocket or something. And they said, well, it's to cut down the shoplifting. And so that's the reason a lot of things have more packaging than they need. And I guess it worked.
I guess it also makes you feel like you're buying something really substantial. You know, if you, I know. My wife, when she bought this iPod, it came in a box that was gallons too big for it. You know, and just had all this packaging in it.
There's something psychological about that.
Yeah.
Let's talk with another listener in Rockford, line 4. Hi.
Howdy. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Had comments on two things. The first thing I heard on your show was talking about there being 5 to 10 pounds of lead in an analog television set.
It depends on how big the TV is, I guess.
Well, I have wired some television sets. I'm an electrical engineer.
Yeah.
I've wired some big ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I could probably take 1 pound roll of solder and wire 20
television
sets.
No, it's not the solder. It's the lead in the cathode ray tube that shields the radiation from escaping from the cathode ray tube.
Okay, all right. So, there is some lead there.
It's called frit glass. It's the lining of the cat. You know, it's a lot of people wonder what I'm talking about. Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up. It's called frit glass.
Yeah.
A mixture of lead and glass, and it's very hard to.
Did you say flint glass?
Sorry.
What was the flint glass?
Frit.
FRIT. Oh, frit. Okay.
In order to prevent the radioactivity from escaping from the tube, it's a really old fashioned kind of thing, a cathode ray. They line it with lead, and what happens in China in these breaking yards is people go at them with hammers, and smash them, and then melt the stuff down to in order to reclaim the lead. It's really and the lead
okay.
gets the water into their bloodstream into their kids.
Yeah. All right. And the other thing I had to comment. Can you still hear?
Yeah. Sure.
Was that the short life of things in a disposable society, I feel, I have lived through the World War II and seen the aftermath there, and I think the low-quality Japanese products that have been brought over to this country are meant to use one day and throw away the next day, or use one year and throw away the next year, have contributed very, very greatly to our throwaway society.
Yeah, I think starting with the transistor, you may be right. With transistor radios.
Okay. Well, Lena, thank the listener for his call. And that was a good question about the television set, too. I'm glad he called in and we could give some more information there. One last caller this afternoon, line 2, Champagne. Hi.
Thank you so much. I'm really curious. Your general perspective seems to be very correct. And I'm just curious about one particular aspect. In the world of biology, you know, insects, for example, find ways to attack plants. Plants find ways to respond.
Uh-huh.
In the world of warfare, people find ways to make better weapons, and then they find ways to defend against them. And in the world of technology, people find ways to build better hardware, and then the people who build the software build better software. So you've been talking about the iPod and the General Electronics. How do you respond to the idea or the argument that some of the disposability comes because we keep creating new software that takes advantage of the hardware and requires new hardware?
Yeah.
And that's kind of against your theory that this is all planned obsolescence. This is just software taking advantage of new hardware, and I'll just go ahead and listen offline. Thank you.
Okay.
I've got a P4 or word processor that I wrote my book on, and I don't game, I use the internet for research and email a lot, so I don't really need a super high functioning computer that with, you know, a really advanced video card that, you know, maybe my son would prefer because he's a video game addict. There's something called Moore's Law that that means that that says that the power of a chip will increase in performance, speed, and power every 18 months, will double in power every 18 months. So it's possible every 18 months to create a new device that's twice as powerful, twice as fast. And because the marketplace is competitive and because there are no checks on the marketplace, that's what happens. So Ericsson brings out a phone. 2 months later, Motorola brings out a phone that's much more powerful, has many more features, and that's the way it goes. The trouble, I guess, is that that this creates enormous amount of e-waste, and that e-waste is, despite the fact that we think electronics is a really clean industry, it's not. It's very dirty. It's dirty upstream in terms of producing these devices, and it's dirty downstream in terms of getting rid of them. So what they've done in Europe is they've forced electronic manufacturers to stop using as many toxins as they have in the past in these devices and to find new ways of soldering them that don't use lead, for example, and many other things. And then they've also forced them to pay to collect, take back, disassemble, and reuse these devices. And there's legislation like that before Congress now, and this is and it's crucial now because by 2009 we'll be overwhelmed by analog TVs. So the answer really is that we have to follow Europe's lead and put some brakes on IT manufacturers that haven't been there before. Mm-hmm. And I guess the argument between software and hardware is really a kind of chicken and egg argument, and I'm just not a smart enough guy to sort it out. Mm-hmm. But they support and encourage each other. Every time Bill Gates brings out a new version of Windows, you need a more powerful computer to run it.
And there, I've got to jump in.
All right.
And say, we're out of time, unfortunately.
Thank
the
you.
The grandfather clock says.
I love that. I love that. I'm going to use that.
Okay.
All right.
Giles, thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure.
Giles Slade has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Made to Break: Technology and Obsolescence in America, the publisher, Harvard University Press.